Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today, I have a person from the other side from where I live, and her name is Camila Chance, and she is an author. And we're going to bring her on because she has a story to tell, since she has written a book, and it's quite interesting. So, Camila, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Nancy. And as I mentioned a minute ago, it's a great honor to be with you.
And I thank you. It's also a great honor to have you on. Now, Camila, let's talk a little bit about who you are first, and then we're going to go into your book, Wisdom Man. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about Camila, when you became a writer, and what prompted you to do that?
Well, I've been writing all my life. When I was 5 years old and could read and write, I said to my parents, I want to write books when I grow up. And they became extremely angry because they were very conservative, and my father particularly, it was a red rag to a bull. But being a child, I went on saying, I want to write books when I grow up. And they saw me as a threat because a true lady doesn't say anything, has no opinion, and is an ornament to the home. So I was the first person in my family actually to work, and I've had a lot of jobs, writing lyrics for a performing group who went all over the world singing and dancing on their elbows called the Kaban Cossacks from behind the Iron Curtain, who were naturalized Australian, and they performed three times a night every night in Las Vegas, singing my lyrics and dancing more energetic than normal Russian dancers, dancing on their elbows. And I also was an editor for Faber and Faber in London, a school teacher, and I was a little bit similar to the teacher in Dead Poets Society. I took my children outside to teach them out in the garden, and I took them on excursions, and this was quite frowned on, and in the end I virtually became sacked. In fact, I was sacked, but I was allowed to continue for the rest of the year. And it was important for me to do that because I felt I would be letting my pupils down if I didn't. So my husband kept saying, leave, and I wouldn't. So my pupils got good marks, and I still keep up with them, although it's years and years ago. I've had other work, and I'm married with two children, three grandchildren, and I've been friends with Aboriginal people since I became a Baha'i. What happened was my grandmother was really the only person in the family from whom I felt love or warmth. And she was the opposite side of the world from me nearly all my life. But she said she hoped that when I finished at Melbourne University in Australia, and it's a very hard-working top, it's the top university in the state. So she wanted me to come and spend my life with her when I'd finished there. But I met my husband when I was at university, and I said to him, we are falling in love, and my grandmother wanted me to spend my life with her, and said, very conveniently, you can marry a Swiss, because she lived in Switzerland, and I feel I owe her a year of my life. And my husband had had a very hard life, also a very hard early childhood, and he understood my attachment to my grandmother, and although he had not become my husband then, I spent this year overseas with my grandmother, and my husband and I intended to get married when I came back. And we did. And while I was overseas, I met Baha'is. My grandmother said, I'm taking you tonight to meet some people who are working toward unity because I know now what you're looking for in your heart. You've been with me almost a year. And I just laughed. I said there are groups working toward unity at Melbourne University and they don't have their hearts in it. And I went anyway, and I was completely bowled over by the atmosphere there, because I had been terribly distressed coming from Australia by the hierarchy in Switzerland. There were people who played cards with the Queen of Spain. Actually, they were my relations who did that. And the porters at the railway stations groveled in front of my grandmother and me because she was a baroness. And because my grandfather was Russian, and of course they came out as the Russian Revolution broke out. That was the Bolshevik Revolution and eventually became communism. So they escaped, and they had friends who were mostly escaped people as well in Switzerland, and they formed the top hierarchy. And the porters who groveled before us at the railway stations were around the bottom. And I was terribly distressed by this, and I had thought, what on earth could break this hierarchy? And when I went into this room full of Baha'is, I was overwhelmed by the atmosphere of love there. And it wasn't so much that the people from the top echelons absolutely loved those from other walks of life. I could feel that overwhelmingly. But what impressed me most was the people who outside might have been porters at a station, who were very, very poor people, who were in the same jobs all their lives and not much chance of changing them. Those people had immense confidence, and they spoke out with immense wisdom, and they were so certain of being loved by everyone in the room. And I thought, it has to be something really big to change people so fundamentally. And I thought my first duty, no matter what, was to find out what was behind it. And when I found out, I became a Baha'i immediately. I felt as if all my relations, my conservative relations, were lined up all around me saying, don't. But I rebelled because I had to. My spirit wanted that. And so because I was a Baha'i, of course, when I came back to Australia, I certainly felt very humble towards Aboriginal people and the people in the that had the hardest time in Australia and that were despised at the time in Australia. So it was very natural for me to become friends with Aboriginal people, and there was actually an Aboriginal person in my Baha'i community when I arrived back in Australia where I was living. And thus, of course, eventually I met Banjo Clark and took 27 years writing down his story, his philosophy, his life, which was very wonderful and very tragic. And he forgave people 1,000 times 1,000 for the terrible injustice that he and his family suffered. And it was a meeting of souls when I met him. We both recognized in each other that we had universal love, and that was the link. And as I said, I dedicated 27 years to writing down his story in the book, Wisdom Man by Banjo Clark, as told to Camilla Chance, which is published by Penguin, and which you can order from barnesandnoble.com or amazon.com, and you can get onto these through my website. And my website is very interesting, and it's www.wisdommanbook.com. And on the website there are 4 videos, one with Banjo talking himself, and he had the most beautiful way of talking and talked from his heart and soul. And there are 3 other videos too, one of a United States woman who experienced a kind of miracle in relation, or what she saw as a miracle in relation to the book Wisdom Man, and 2 others, one with me talking a bit, and one that's a short preamble to a film that might be made. And there are all sorts of quotes from the book and quotes from Bencher on that website, www.wisdommanbook.com. So that's about it, I think, on the subject of me.
Okay. Now, as I was reading the book and listening to what you just said, there's parts of it that was very common between the two of you, and that was, you know, some of the ways that you grew up may not quite been as harsh as what Banjo's was, but they were nevertheless kind of the same. When you were interviewing him, did you feel that that might be a way of the two of you connecting, or did you feel connected because of that?
Yes, I felt connected because of that, because at the time that we met, white people had no idea, most white people had no idea of the hardship that Aboriginal people suffered, and they simply did not believe them. There was a secret campaign from the government from the first settlement of Australia to take away Aboriginal children, particularly the children that had been fathered by white people, because the superintendents of Aboriginal missions and settlements very often fathered a great many children from the Aboriginal women. There was a huge shortage of white women in Australia, almost until the present day. And so it was the white overseers, the white superintendents, who actually often organized for their own children to be taken away that were half Aboriginal. And the government saw it as a good chance to get rid of Aboriginal people in a more gentle way than massacres. There were terrible massacres to start with, but after that there was a secret campaign to remove Aboriginal children, particularly fairly light-skinned Aboriginal children, on the slightest pretext. And so the orphanages, the police and doctors that were involved, writing new birth certificates, giving the children new names so that they could not be traced, and the foster families that they went to, all had no idea that this was a large-scale thing. They would be told there is a child whose parents couldn't look after him or her very well, and so he's coming into your home or into the orphanage, or she. But they did not admit that this was happening wide-scale, large-scale. And I met a huge number of Aboriginal children who had grown up, who were seeking their relatives, who were trying to find their roots again, who had found out at long last that they had been Aboriginal children. And they seemed to say, invariably they did say, I had an older brother or sister who looked after me. They are dead now. So it seemed that the only ones who survived were those whose older brother or sister took the brunt of the cruelty, and those that were on their own, because all the families were split up, the children were split up from each other as a policy and sent to different orphanages. All the others died. So anyhow, they told me this, and they told me what hardships they had suffered in the orphanages, and they told other white people too occasionally, and the others did not believe them. And I believed them because of my background. I knew how cruel white people could be to their own. There was a policy of hardship, giving the children hardship, and I was a war baby anyway. And during the war in London, where I was as a child, people were so keen on having a stiff upper lip and not having fear that they blotted out all feelings, in my experience, the people around me, except for my grandmother. So, yes, the thing is that I believed them, and I, of course, believed Banjo. And I was outstanding in believing them because white people just didn't. And it was not necessary for me to tell them about any hardships I had suffered. They were expressing to me enough hardship for the two of us or the three of us or however many it was at the time. They were expressing enough hardship, and it was as if they were talking for me in a way in some of the things they described. So yes, there was that link that I felt, and they trusted me because I believed them.
I think, you know, trust and belief in somebody is very important if you're going to write any kind of a story, because a lot of people, not a lot, some people will get facts that are very true facts, and then somehow to make the story better, they will twist it around. And I don't think that works very well. But Banjo, you know, he, according to your book and to his tale now, you know, you said that their people did not allow things to be written down, that they told stories, you know, through talking, you know, that kind of stories, not necessarily writing down. So why did they allow you to really write the story about Banjo?
Well, after I first met Banjo and his family, a delegation of his children came to see me, and they said, "We trust you. We want you to write about us." And his children forgot that they'd done this, because I said immediately, "I don't know you well enough." And that was 27 years before Wisdom Man was published. So I said, "I don't know you well enough." And a long time later, they had forgotten that they had done this, but Banjo and I remembered, and so we just quietly went on with him telling me things and my writing them down. And it is true that Aboriginal people tend to be very secretive about their ways, particularly their spiritual life, because they felt that others would laugh at them, that white people would laugh at them if they knew. And it's a spiritual life where they feel totally surrounded by the spiritual world all the time. There is constant interaction, and they see very, very little difference between being passed on into the spiritual realm and being in the material realm walking around. There is almost no division at all. And they could not communicate this to white people, and any manifestation of it, they thought they would be laughed at for expressing. So that was the situation. And what happened was that Banjo felt that the whole world was becoming much in need of Aboriginal wisdom and Indigenous wisdom generally, that the world was headed for a great crisis, a great disaster, out of its own greed, out of human greed. And he saw the only way to save this and to change this was for people to change their hearts, to change from the grassroots up. It was no use changing institutions if people's hearts were not changed. It would just be the same prejudices over again and the same ways, the same corrupt ways over again. So he was so conscious of the world needing this that he spoke out to me. And for generations, the old people of Aboriginal tribes had stopped telling the young people about their ways, about their fundamental laws and beliefs, because they no longer trusted the younger generation. It was forbidden to pass the law on, and because so many children had been taken away and indoctrinated, they didn't trust them anymore. But Banjo was an exception. The old people trusted him, and from an early age, from his early childhood, he was always with the old people, and they told him their ways. So it's just a book that has found its time, and it is time for Aboriginal wisdom and Indigenous wisdom to be recognized by the world as a way of being, a new way of being. And actually, all this harmonizes with the Baha'i faith, which I embraced, the Baha'i faith actually teaches that indigenous people who are true to their old laws are living the closest to how God wants us to live in our future. So, yes, they're living the closest to how the earth should be in our immediate future.
I think it's real important, Camila, that people actually treat the earth with love, kindness, and respect, which we have basically forgotten how to do. And I know that, you know, the American Indians here, the Native American Indians, I should say, are also very much, you know, in order with Banjo's thoughts, because they are also trying to get it through to us that, you know, we have mistreated the earth and we mistreated people and we've mistreated many, many things. And there does come a time that, you know, all of that mistreatment in whatever form it is or to what it's been given does have to catch up and balance itself out, which most of the people believe that now is the time. And so the thought of 2012, you know, petrifies a lot of people because they think the whole world is going to come to an end, but that's really not what's going to be going on. But there has to be changes, and there has to be changes like now. And a lot of people know that, you know. So the book, I think, was real, really good based upon his knowledge and his wisdom and him wanting to share it, because it is time for people to learn how to love one another, to learn how to love yourself, learn how to not have these bitter enemies that we have for whatever reason. And I think it's very important that people of today, you know, understand that it is their choice to either do it, as Banjo said, an easy way or a hard way. And unfortunately, too many people still think they have to do it the hard way. And so it may take a disaster, or it may take a lot more, let's just say, not such nice things happening for people to really wake up. And I think that's very important. So, yeah, I think Wisdom Man right now, for most people, it would be to their benefit to read it to see, you know, how things were and how much better it has become. But it's still not perfect, and they still have to do their part in order to make it perfect. You know, so when you were writing the book and you taped all of his conversations first, is that how you did it, Camila?
I taped a huge number of conversations, but Banjo invariably said the best things when the tape had run out. So I would, when I left him from a time recording, I would park the car just a little way away so that he would not get self-conscious about it and write down everything he had said after the tape ran out, while it was totally fresh. So there was both of that.
Yeah, and again, I think that's pretty important. He did a lot of quotes in the book, and on the website, you have a lot of his quotes. And one of them that I found kind of interesting, it says, "I want us to cross a bridge to which we never return." When he made those kind of quotes, did he explain what those quotes meant or why he may have said them?
Yes, he did explain, and there are some things he said that are not in the book, but yet you get it from the book. And something he said was, "When forgiveness and love of the planet and love of the people that walk upon it are our main priorities in life, then things get easier between people, then the disputes tend to fade away, and the ultimate goal is the laughter returns." He believed, and I do too, that there are no bad people in the world, only unhappy ones. And he thought that humankind should wipe their slate of interracial torment clean and meet for the first time in peace and unity. He had this feeling that if you meet everybody that you meet for the first time with open hearts and open hands, that expecting to be friends for life, that will change the world. Everybody will change that meets you. Some will remain liars, but you will be stronger than the liars. So, yes, and also I could add to that expressing gratitude first thing in the morning, gratitude for the day that is dawning, the day that is coming, will make you feel the beauty around you, make you notice the wonderful things about the day, and everybody you meet will be affected by your happiness, and they will become happier too. So that's something that I would add as well. But certainly the Baha'i faith states that this is an age for deeds. The Baha'i faith also states, never underestimate the power of thought. So that is very important, but it should translate into deeds. This is an age for deeds now. That is what is important.
Mm-hmm. As you rewrote, but as you put the book together so it could be published, was there any parts of the book, Camilla, that stood out more from your heart than any of the other parts of the book?
Well, there is something that attracted the publishers in the first place. So I'll tell you that story if you like.
Sure.
That you'd like me to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is about Banjo's firstborn son, his firstborn, who was 18 months old when he passed on. And what happened was that his firstborn had been perfectly well for months and months and months. He had suffered from chest troubles, but for months he had been perfectly well, and he showed no sign of illness at all on that day. And there was a particular day where he watched from his window at 18 months old and ran out to every wagon, every horse-drawn cart that passed their gate, all the children on their way to school, all their children on their way back from school, all the people going to work, and every single individual that passed their gate, he ran out and shook their hand and said something in his childish way. And Banjo says in the book that everybody was really happy and went on their way feeling great because this little boy had run out to them and shook their hand and spoken to them in a childish way. And it made the people happy, but it, of course, because they lived so close to the spiritual realm, it made his parents and his grandparents very uneasy indeed. And they said, we feel he's going to be taken from us. There's something wrong. He's never done this before. And later that night, he suddenly was not able to breathe. So they took him into the hospital, and the people in the hospital said, we'd better keep him in overnight, because Banjo explained to them that every time they'd come to the hospital before, they'd just been sent home with him. And that was the story of Aboriginal people everywhere. They were just sent home with aspirin when they'd come to a hospital, and the next time they came, they would be dying, and they'd die there. So anyhow, the hospital said, we'd better have him overnight, if this has happened so often that he's been turned away. And the parents went home, and then at 3 a.m, the school teacher came past their house. And, of course, the family had no telephone, but the school teacher did. And the school teacher said, the hospital rang me, telephoned me, and you are to come in immediately. So the school teacher drove them into the hospital. And when they came in, they found that their little boy had passed away, and he was holding a beautiful flower in his hands, a beautiful rose. And Banjo said to the nurse, ain't he beautiful? And the nurse said, yes, he looked so beautiful when he passed on that we felt he needed a flower in his hands before his parents came to see him. He seemed to be telling us very strongly that he needed a flower in his hands. And Banjo said the hospital people didn't know that he was never without wild flowers in his hands, little Vernon. He loved wild flowers. And his grandfather, who not his real grandfather, but his tribal grandfather who came to see him often would always bring wild flowers to him when he came. So and the hospital said to the people, we don't know what to do. He seemed to be perfectly all right and going all right, and then suddenly he passed on. And the parents took his body home. And very soon afterward, his tribal grandfather turned up outside their window. And it is Aboriginal custom not to come up and knock on a door when they visit a person. It is the custom to hang around outside until they are seen, and then the host or hostess will invite them in. So they followed the tribal custom, which in a tribal situation is if somebody is visiting another tribe, they will sit a little distance away where they can be seen but where they cannot overhear the conversation. And the elders of the tribe will discuss whether they should invite him in. It's usually a him. And when they finish their discussion, they will send a little boy out to invite him in, and they'll give the person every hospitality once he's accepted. So anyhow, Aboriginal people having great integrity and always finding an Aboriginal way of doing things in a modern new situation adapted this, and so Grandfather Tarek was standing some distance away where he could be seen from the window, and Banjo and his wife saw him, and he had no wild flowers in his hands. And they said, he's acting as if he knows. But how could he know? Because he had been in town for several days, and when Grandfather Tarek was on his way home from town, he would stop at a halfway house, and it would take him 2 days to walk home. So they said, how could he possibly know? And then they saw Grandfather Tarek take his hat off. And they said, he must know, but how could he know? So Banjo went out to see him, and he said, I have bad news for you. And Grandfather Tarek said, I know. And Banjo said, our little boy passed away in the night. And Grandfather Tarek said, I know. And he wouldn't tell them how he knew. And then 3 months after the little boy was buried, Grandfather Tarek said, now I will tell you how I knew. I was staying in the halfway house, and in the middle of the night, about 3 a.m, I felt this great weight on my feet. And I thought it was one of the dogs, and I hunted him off and yelled at him and kicked and threw something at him. But the weight remained on my feet. So I lit a match, and I saw a little white coffin on my feet. And immediately I thought of your little boy, and I knew it was a message from him that he had passed on. And I didn't delay. As soon as it became light, I wasted no time and came straight over to see you, came straight home. So that was the incident in the book that drew the publishers in and made them want to publish it. It touched them most deeply. But the book is full of all kinds of incidents where the spiritual realm is close to the material realm, and there's this interaction the whole time. And this is something that a lot of people have lost in this over-civilized world. They don't feel this closeness where Aboriginal people, so long as they are trying to do the right thing, they feel themselves constantly protected by their ancestors and by the spiritual realm generally. They feel surrounded by love, and they love them back. And it gives them this confidence to go anywhere. They'll walk through the desert and know that they will be shown the signs to find water when they need water. And they don't get uptight and tense and therefore miss the signs, because they are so sure that they are loved. And they know that the spiritual realm will tell them when there is danger through their intuition. And so unless they get that message, they know that everything will be all right. And we have lost that a lot. And we have lost also the sharing, the sharing that Banjo saw as natural among little children, among babies, that it was a natural instinct to share. And this was developed, and compassion was developed in little children from birth. A mother would point out an insect and say, oh, poor thing, it's going the wrong way, and foster compassion for all things, all living things, for everything in their children from birth. And again, babies want to share, and I remember when my daughter held out her spoon to my mother when she was learning to feed herself, my mother said, I don't want it. And of course, if people treat their babies like that later when the baby is a little older, children usually in white families get taught to share where it had been natural. And so it's a bit of a tough job later when they are taught. And again, I had this instinct of always accepting it when my daughter tried to share anything. And I had this in common with Aboriginal people too. I couldn't understand why people as children would be encouraged to share, and then when they grew up, suddenly there was no more sharing with the outside world among many people. I couldn't understand that. And this great division of riches and poverty, there shouldn't be the great division. It's not realistic to expect people all to have the same possessions, although in Aboriginal life they did, but in more material life it's not possible. But there shouldn't be this enormous division between riches and poverty.
I agree totally with that. And I also agree, you know, the children come here full of love, full of compassion, and all they want to do is to share and continue to love. And through the growth process of today's world, as you call it, the over-civilized world, we have forgotten how to do those things. And so the children of today is where I really come from, because I came to New Mexico to build a school for the children called the School of Now, so that these children have all of the upbringing, or not necessarily the upbringing, but all of the teaching of basically the old ways, the ways that we've forgotten, and not just in the Aborigines, but just in general, because there are many, many things that people have pushed off to the side for whatever reason to make sure that they have their own whatever they want, and if somebody else does not have it, that's just kind of too bad. So my thought was to create a school of now that one would never be outdated, and these children would be actually able to be who they are with the love that they have and the knowledge that they have without anybody trying to take it away or change it. And so I just started working toward that. Although I worked at it for 5 years, I just now got the land for it. So it's in the process, and I think it will be very important, because I think these children of today, instead of being handed out drugs like it's candy, they need to be shown what love and compassion and sharing is really all about. And I don't think they're getting that today.
That's wonderful. And Banjo and I both believe that people with immense compassion are those that can change the world. And that's what's needed now. And I salute you for your immense compassion. And we need it desperately. We need it desperately because there will be a great disaster, which will come about through our own corruption if we don't change our hearts. If a lot of people do not change their hearts pretty much immediately. And certainly a school of now, that is the eternal present. That is how Aboriginal people live, in the eternal present. And there can be many illustrations of this, but it is basically this huge interaction with the spiritual realm. When I wrote about the passing of Ian's a younger son who I knew, who was quite old when he passed on, i.e. in his 20s, or even maybe he was in his very early 30s, but I knew him well and loved him deeply, as I loved all people, but I was very fond of Ian. And when Ian passed on, Banjo was proud of lamenting his death out loud. So he passed on from a heart attack, and when the ambulance men came and took him out in a stretcher from the house and took him to the back of the ambulance and put him in the ambulance, the full moon shone on Ian's face, and he looked as if he were alive again. And Ian had always loved the moon that lit up their spiritual land, their bushland, and he loved to watch it. And Banjo followed the coffin out. Oh, sorry, he followed the stretcher out, and he called out to the universe and to Ian, wake up, Ian, don't lose, don't go. And he kept calling it out, and he was really proud of calling it out. And this was such a contrast with my upbringing, where I was taught that the people who squash their feelings are the adults. To Aboriginal people, having the right emotion was the sign of maturity, whereas among the people I was brought up with, totally being without emotion was a sign of being mature, being an adult and not childish. And of course, Aboriginal people looked very, very gently on those who massacred them as little children whose emotions had not been brought out correctly or brought out at all. So anyhow, this was a contrast, and when I wrote about it for the book Wisdom Man, I brought it to Banjo and said, is this all right? Because I have added a little bit so that readers would understand the situation. And Banjo gave it back to me after he had kept my manuscript overnight, and he said, you wrote a true word. I see Ian lying there. I see him passed on. I see him lying there on the kitchen floor before me when he passed on. And that was his test of my truthfulness and integrity, that he relived it. He would relive everything as if it were happening now. It was still happening to him. Everything was still happening. And I said, but I added a little bit. I added that at every funeral and when anybody passes on, Aboriginal people relive every funeral that they had ever been to and every person who had passed on from them, every person in their life. And they relive all those moments when they are at a new funeral or where new people have passed on. And Banjo said, oh, you only wrote that so Gabbas can understand, you know, so white people can understand. And he approved of me writing that little bit extra. But the point is that he lived in the eternal present, and even the book is written more or less in the eternal present, because he didn't have a sense of time. And again, little children in Aboriginal situations are taught from babyhood their history about the massacres and about the ways of the past as much as possible. And therefore, if Banjo described a massacre to me, he actually was living it at the time of describing it. And he would even tell me the expressions on the white people's faces. So anyhow, it was totally real to him. And he didn't like doing that. He didn't like describing a massacre. And of course, he described those who suffered with immense compassion. There was one massacre where little children were buried up to their heads in sand, and the white people took turns kicking their heads off. And the other little children, their friends and their brothers and sisters, were lined up behind, waiting their turn. And Banjo, of course, suffered tremendously telling that, and said, imagine what was going through the little children's heads as they saw their mates being having their heads kicked off. Anyway.
How do you, Camila, how do you think anyone, not just the Aborigines, but anyone, would be able to forget that scene, you know, of seeing that happen? And I'm sure that that's not the only lands that it's happened on, because they used to also torture the black people here, and they used to torture the Native American Indians here. So how do people forgive that? When Banjo was talking about it, how could he forgive watching or hearing about it or seeing it? How could he somehow find the strength to forgive that?
Well, that is because Aboriginal people live in the eternal present. And traditionally, they do not bear grudges because they live in the present. What happens now is what is important. And certainly, there was an immense example of forgiveness. And of course, I should just mention that people who read Wisdom Man are changed. Everywhere I go, I meet people who say, I have read Wisdom Man, and I was a very, very angry person who could not forgive the people who had harmed me until I read that book. And now I feel peaceful, and I have been able to forgive everyone that I ever thought did anything to me, because I have met Banjo's very, very solid character in the book, and it's just as if he has been sitting in the room talking to me, and he forgave everybody 1,000 times 1,000, and meeting his character and feeling his atmosphere and his wisdom has caused me to change totally, and I now feel peaceful. And if a person didn't say that to me, they said, I have a friend who read your book, or Banjo's book, and he used to be very angry, or she used to be very angry, and now she or he has changed and become peaceful. So I've met people all over the world, countless people who have said that to me. The book does change lives. But as I was mentioning before, there is a very good example of this, of Aboriginal people not bearing grudges. And that is our present Prime Minister apologized in February 2008, 12th of February. He made an official apology on behalf of his government to Aboriginal people for their children having been taken away in such masses, on such a huge scale, and brought up in orphanages and not told they were Aboriginal. And the Aboriginal people all over Australia said, an apology needs a reaction. It can either be accepted or rejected, and we accept it. And in fact, we didn't want money, but how could we heal before? If nobody acknowledged that we had anything to heal from, all these broken up families, mothers in despair, children barely surviving and some not surviving from being taken away. And so all over Australia, Aboriginal people had big dinners. They held big dinners to which they invited a lot of white people. And they gave speeches at the dinner, and they had music and dancing, and it was all to express acceptance of the apology. And the speeches were accepting the apology. They would say bad things happened, but basically we are really, really happy now. It is this immense sigh of relief throughout the Aboriginal world that we can both go on hand in hand now and meet as equals in a way. And so I was, of course, invited to one of these dinners in the north of Australia, and I was living in the south. And the Aboriginal family who invited me, I sat at their table. There were lots and lots of tables where people had been invited. And the Governor General of Australia chose to sit at the same table. She was not officially at our table, but she came and sat at our table and chose to be with us. And so I gave her a copy of Wisdom Man. I had had the feeling that I should bring one copy with me. And so I gave it to the Governor General of Australia. And she read it and wrote me a beautiful letter about it. So it's all very good, and this kind of thing needs to happen, I think. But there was this immense acceptance of the apology and this huge sigh of relief among Aboriginal people that now they could get on with their lives and not feel this agony.
It's too bad the rest of the world, who've gone through so many things, can't do the same, it appears. Hopefully down the road they will be able to do that, though. That would be a very, very big world improvement if they could apologize and accept apologies for what has gone on. Now, before we run out of time, because we're almost out of time already, give out the name of your book again, where they can get it, and your website, please.
All right. The website is www.wisdommanbook.com, and you can get it anywhere if you want to order it from an ordinary bookstore. You just ask for Wisdom Man by Camilla Chance, or Chance, as I would say, and that is how it is listed in booksellers' books, and it's published by Penguin US now. It was published by Penguin Australia and still is, but it's also published by Penguin US and published in other countries too. And through my website, you can very easily order it from barnesandnoble.com or from amazon.com. You can just click on a picture of the book, a picture of Banjo, and go straight through to the link in amazon.com or barnesandnoble.com, from which you can order it. But the full title of the book is Wisdom Man by Banjo Clark, as told to Camilla Chance, The Compassionate Life and Beliefs of a Remarkable Aboriginal Elder. However, I believe that it's listed as Wisdom Man by Camilla Chance, because that is the legal name for it. Legally, the person who wrote it down is the author, but I always refer to it as Banjo's book.
Okay, well, that's very nice. Now, you mentioned a little bit earlier that there's a possibility that there was going to be a film made. Do you know, is it a great possibility, or is it already in the works, and do you know when it might be coming out?
Well, actually, it would be absolutely wonderful if I were approached about a feature film, and of course I would hand that proposition on to Banjo's children as well, but we would love it if there were a feature film. At the moment, there have been several documentaries about Banjo, and I have spoken on them. There have been documentaries shown on Australian television a lot of times, and certainly Bob Keaton in America has been working on a documentary too, but I don't know when that will come out. And Banjo's children and I feel that a feature film would do a lot of good, so we're hoping that somebody will take that up as well.
That would be great. And the last thing, just before we're out of time, when they had his funeral, there was the whole place was absolutely filled, according to the picture, because there's pictures in your book, and they're really neat pictures, but the whole place was filled.
Yes, that is absolutely true. There were 3,000 people at Banjo's funeral, and we had to erect a gigantic marquee, but still there were people who couldn't fit in it. And somebody who got up to speak at Banjo's funeral opened his arms, and he said, he quoted a proverb, "It is appointed unto man once to die, and after that the judgment." And he opened his arms to the crowd and said, "Well, this is the judgment." Banjo possessed absolutely nothing, and yet statesmen from all over the world came to consult him toward the end of his life. and his book was launched by the former Prime Minister of Australia, and he also wrote a foreword to the book. Anyway, there was a traffic jam in a meadow when the people came to Benjo's funeral, and the area had never seen such a gigantic funeral before or since.
That's great. Camilla, our time is actually up. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and let us know about your book. And I'm sure after hearing you talk, a lot of people may order your book, and I think it's very much worth it because I read the book, and it's very, very interesting. You know, it's kind of heart-wrenching in parts of it, and other parts of it make total sense to me. So, you know, I think the book was very good, so I'd like to thank you very much for doing the sharing that you did today.
Well, thank you very much, Nancy, and thank you to all your listeners. And as I said, it's an honor to enjoy your hospitality and to be invited to speak.
You're very welcome. You take care of yourself, and you have another book coming out in 2011. We'll look forward to seeing that one also.
Thank you so much, and good luck with your School of Now. More power to your Elmo.
I thank you. You take care. And again, thanks for being on the show. And I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. I hope you have a great week, and take a look at the book. It's very much worth the time. So take care, and we'll talk later. Bye now.